Hello and welcome to the latest Science Sport Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Solomon, and today I'm delighted to be joined by John DeWitt. So John is a Director of Applied Sports Science at Rice University in Houston, Texas. And he also consults for a range of different organizations and different clubs throughout the globe. That can be Major League Baseball, NBA, MLS, all the way through to Olympic and Paralympic teams. Next to that, he's also got 20 years experience working with NASA on a range of different biomechanics projects, which makes him the perfect person today to discuss how we can use force plates to monitor and measure fatigue. So without further ado, it's time to welcome John onto the show. John, welcome to the Science of Sport Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Matt. I'm excited to talk about sports and science and how we can use it to make athletes better.
Absolutely. Excellent. Me too. So before we get into that, can you give us a quick introduction as to who you are and what you've been up to until now?
Sure. So my name is Dr. John DeWitt. I am based in Houston, Texas. Currently, I have two main roles. The first is I am the Director of Applied Sports Science at Rice University, employed by the athletic department to oversee the use of sports science data across the 14 teams, roughly 360 student athletes that we have at this NCAA Division I institution. I've had that position formally since last summer. Informally, I was consulting with them on the use of sports science data for about the last 3 or 4 years. I also am the president and CEO of a consultancy called DeWitt Method. The DeWittMethod.com is my home website, and with my consultancy, I do similar sports science work relating sports science data to usable and actionable information that coaches can use. I have clients in the NBA, I have clients in Major League Soccer, clients in USA Olympic and Paralympic Committee teams. Past clients include European soccer teams, NCAA football teams, and there's a long list. In those areas, I will work directly with the coaching and medical staff to utilize sports science data. And when I say sports science data, I'm talking about things that we would collect in the gym, like force plate data, but also things we would collect out on the field or on the court, like player movement data, speed, Excel, D-cell, these sort of things. Basically helping to put information from tables of numbers and decode that into actionable information that coaches can use. So these are my two primary roles now. Prior, in the last few years, I held a position with the Chicago Cubs baseball team as their senior biomechanist, looking at motion capture data that was collected on the field from baseball and baseball pitcher and hitters, looking specifically at biomechanics and how these biomechanical things can be used to either understand how a person is throwing or hitting or improve them. And then I also spent 20 years, I actually still have an affiliation at NASA Johnson Space Center, where I was a senior biomechanist performing research on exercise in spaceflight for astronauts and how it can be used to reduce bone and muscle loss. There's a bunch of other things that I've done, but those are the major highlights.
So there's definitely some highlights in there. So, I mean, we could do the whole NASA thing on a different podcast, right? Like, I would love to go into the detail of how what that is and how you can apply it to sport. But we're here today to discuss how you can monitor fatigue using force plates. So can you give us a quick introduction as to, firstly, what fatigue is and why it's important for sports? You mentioned a few different ones, but like basketball or baseball, for example.
Yeah, sure. So to me, fatigue is essentially a decrease in performance. And it's difficult, I think, to be able to say when you see fatigue, to know exactly what the cause is. That's the second step. The first step is to identify. That can help create the conversation or the discussion that can lead to wear. So when I say wear, I'm talking about it could be the muscles are fatigued. It could be the central nervous system is fatigued. It could be there's an injury that's manifesting itself, and maybe it's not something that we see but we end up seeing some difference in a measurement that might point to, hey, there's something going on here. So I would say, and this is my engineering and biomechanics background talking, fatigue is a breakdown in tissue. And the question is, where is that coming from? We can't just say fatigue is fatigue. There, we have to take the next step and identify where is fatigue actually coming from.
And what's the role of fatigue in sports then? So obviously, yeah, it's kind of intuitive. You get tired, you perform badly, but is that the case in all sports, or does it manifest in slightly different ways sometimes in different sports? How does that look?
Yeah, so that's another good question. And Matt, I know you're going to ask a lot of great questions, which means I'm going to answer a lot of them with it depends. So I would say, just in general, we would think fatigue is bad. We would think that fatigue is a decrease in performance level, and a decrease in performance level must be accompanied by a decrease in output of whatever we're doing. Doesn't matter what sport we're talking about. I want to flip it on the side, though, and say, well, actually, it could be bad. But also remember, and this is going back to our exercise physiology and our training backgrounds, tissues adapt during recovery. We don't get stronger while we're lifting weights. We get stronger while we're recovering from lifting weights. So in that case, fatigue is good. We've induced fatigue. That's actually going to potentially lead to some sort of supercompensation that makes us better. So I think it's difficult to say fatigue is good or bad. I think we can say it's a you see it with a decrease in a metric that you're using to measure it. So with a force plate, it could be a decrease in peak power, jump height, one of the hundreds of metrics that we can deduce from the force plate curve. The question that you have to ask by context is this fatigue a bad fatigue, meaning this person's overworked and we need to give them some rest? Or is this fatigue a good fatigue in that it's showing us, yeah, we stressed them. Now we're going to expect to see some compensation. And that's where I think there's a difference between being a tech and a sports scientist. The sports tech can operate the equipment that uses to measure fatigue and look at a number and say, hey, coach, this number is down. The sports scientist, like you and me and a lot of our listeners, are the ones that can actually decode whatever that number being down means to help us understand what it is and how we can use it best. So I think I'll wrap up by this question by saying, it's dangerous to think that, well, fatigue is down, down is bad, bad is no good, we should not have them down. I think you have to understand the context to be able to understand or make a good decision on what that means.
I think that's very logical, right? I mean, in the training process, if you're in off season, then fatigue can be fine. If you're one day away from the Super Bowl final or whatever, and you're doing your force plate testing and all your metrics are down, that's maybe not the best time to be completely knackered. But before we get onto how you're going to do that and use it, can you talk us through the different types of fatigue that occur within the body? Because you mentioned, for example, muscles and different systems. So yeah, obviously fatigue can occur in different ways as well. So can you talk us through the different fatigue options which are available to athletes or to coaches?
Yeah, so you know, working yourself from a outside or furthest away from the brain, all the way back to the brain, you know, the first fatigue I would think about would be local muscle or local tissue fatigue. So when I say that, let's be really specific. My calves are tired. I'm not able to create as much force in my plantar flexor motion because my plantar flexors, my calves, my soleus are tired. So that would be a source of fatigue that's tissue related. And of course, fatigue is a general term, but there's different types of fatigue. One would be a decrease in force capability when I'm trying to create force in general. Another would be decreasing the ability to create force repeatedly. So I can jump really well in the first 15 minutes of a match, but in the last 15 minutes, my jumps are starting to suffer. So that would be an endurance type of fatigue. So we have to think about there's different types of fatigue, and I'm sure we could drill down deeper into that. But those are, I think, the two main ones. Capability to actually just express force in general, because we must remember, at the end of the day, muscles create force. That's it. We don't have to go deeper into that. We could if we want. People who are listening to this may say, oh, no, you're making it too simple. And I'll say, no, this is as simple as we need to be. A muscle creates force. If we can't create as much force as we were able to, something's going on. It could be energy systems are down. It could be there's some damage to the tissue. I don't know, because we can't look inside the body. But that would be a source of, I would call, muscle or tissue fatigue. And then, of course, bones provide structure. Bones can become fatigued if there is too much stress played on the bones. Ligaments provide connections. Ligaments can become fatigued if there's too much stress placed on those ligaments. Tendons, on and on and on. All these tissues become fatigued. So that would be one source of fatigue, I would say.
And I'm rudely interrupting, John, to make sure that you're aware of the Science of Sport Coach Academy. Now, the Coach Academy is an overgrowing library of sports science courses which are broken down into bite-sized chunks. So if you're enjoying today's podcast and you want to get your hands on some more great sports science information, you can get into the Coach Academy completely for free using the link in the show notes in just a few minutes' time. So when the podcast is finished, hit that link for your free access. So you mentioned, obviously, the brain plays a role in fatigue as well. So can you walk us through why the brain is important in fatigue management?
Sure. So there's a lot of research in general out in the body of research talking about just how the brain works and control of motor control and coordination and these sort of things. And I think this is a place where we can make a lot of gains in the sports side, because I'm not quite sure we're maximizing as well as we could the brain's capability when people are performing sports. So some of the things that we know from science is with fatigue, body fatigue, decision making becomes impaired. We start to get into a situation where as we are tired, we take longer to make decisions. We make more frequent poor decision. And when I say poor decision, I'm saying maybe we should have stepped to the left to block a pass, but we didn't move, or we moved to the right instead. And research is showing us that body fatigue is actually manifesting itself in decision fatigue. But what we don't know is maybe it's the other way around. Maybe when the brain gets overloaded and has to make lots and lots of decisions, that manifests itself in body fatigue. And how would that happen? Well, in order for my body to do a movement, there has to be some signal that's sent to say, hey, muscles, create force to do the movement. If there's an impairment in that muscle, that signal being sent, I'm not going to move as fast. It's not that my muscles couldn't do it. It's that the signal from my head to my muscles was not fast enough. And so now it looks like, oh, this person's tired in their muscles, but it actually could be, no, they're tired in their brain. The brain is not coming sending signals fast enough. Or, you know, just like what might happen in this podcast, I might have a drop because the brain of our podcast, which is the Zoom software that we're using, can't keep up with the information that's being sent. And so it slows down. It looks like I'm the one who can't speak, but the truth is no, it's the Zoom that can't process it. So I think there's a lot of research out there that shows we can improve this. And this, Matt, just takes us to a whole new level if you think about it, because you could be talking about decision-making in terms of a tactical decision. You could be talking about information processing on how well can I scan and see the field and actually see the field. I can certainly scan with my eyes, but what's coming into my eyes has to be processed by my brain. And if I can't scan that, it doesn't matter. It's like if you watch an elite basketball player, I don't have data on this, but I'm going to use a lot of what I'll call common sense type things. My guess is the best players and the worst players do not move their heads differently. They're playing basketball. They're moving their heads. The best players are probably making decisions with the information they're gleaning faster and more concurrently with other decisions they have to make that the poor players are not. I think that can be trained. And there's ways we can train it because we know when somebody has a traumatic brain injury or a stroke from rehab, we can make them better. Well, why can't we do the same thing with athletes? So that would be maybe I went off a tiny bit off topic, but a little bit about where cognitive fatigue can manifest itself in performance.
So I would love to just go on a complete divergence now and discuss that, how you train that. But let's keep on track. Obviously, force plates are one way that you could potentially measure force outputs. So what's their role then in monitoring fatigue?
There's many different tests that you can do with force plates, but the most common and the simplest to do are counter movement jumps. This is one of my primary measures that we'll use to understand performance and understand fatigue. Typically, a counter movement jump, hands on hips to take the upper body out of it. We use bilateral force plates so we can look at left and right leg differences. Now, oftentimes we'll add in drop jump for reactivity and single leg jump to look at right versus left leg production. One small side note, I don't have the data to prove this, but I have an inkling from my experience is that when I'm on a single leg jump, I'm putting my hip in a different position than when I'm on a dual leg jump. When I'm on a dual leg jump, my hips are typically either at a neutral position or they're abducted. When I'm in a single leg jump, my hip is adducted. It has to be, or else I'll lose balance and fall down. So a single leg jump is going to tell me something about the lower leg kinetic chain, but I think it's different than the counter movement jump symmetry because our hips are in different position. Now, like I said, someone can listen to me and go do the research and figure out if I'm right or not, but this is my belief in general. So that's why I would call symmetry both. We would look at both counter movement and single leg jump. So one of the things that's really important for fatigue or performance, either or, is there has to be a reference point. You can't just look at a number and say, oh, that number's bad or that number's good. Remember, numbers are data, and data is neither good nor bad. They're just data. They're information. The interpretation is what's important. So you asked about how you measure fatigue. Well, the first step is you have to have repeated data on the player in order to be able to use data to understand fatigue. So this is where I am a big believer in get your players. If you have, and since we're talking force plate, I know everyone doesn't have something like this, but let's say you do, because that's what we're talking about. Get them on the force plate as much as possible. Once a week, not once a year. You can't measure fatigue in once a year. Not even once every 6 months. I think that, you know, using force plates and types things like this for physical examinations and pre-participation exams, it's really good. But if you want to use this as a fatigue measure, you have to have jumps that are on a regular basis. So the NBA teams I work with, the players jump before every single game. Someone might say, oh my gosh, that's a lot of overhead. No, it's not. They go into the gym, they do a bunch of prehab activation stuff. They walk over to the force plates, they jump three times, they do three single leg jumps on left, three single leg jumps on the right. See you later. That's it. So we incorporate this sort of assessment into a workout, and we would do this. If you have a system and you're experienced at it, this takes less than 30 seconds for people to do. So it's not difficult, but you need that trend. You need to be able to look at repeated measures to measure fatigue. I'll stop there and let you ask a question if you want, and then I can keep on going.
I think there's a lot of questions to be asked, but I think that's a really nice way of looking at it. So you need a certain, let's say, consistency within your testing to be able to work out what's actually happening, as opposed to having some data from a couple of years ago. You don't know whether it's fatigue, whether they've improved, whether the strength is better, whether the power is better, whether they've just been injured, or that doesn't give context to the data. So I think it's very important to mention the consistency within that, and that it doesn't have to take too long. But then when you have that data, and let's say you are being consistent, you're doing before the games, you get your single leg stuff, you get your counter movement jump, what are then the most important KPIs that people should be looking at? So obviously you can get jump height, which is fine, but there's a ton more variables which are available. So for you, what are the things that people should be looking at when it comes to using force plates to measure readiness?
Sure. So I think it's important that you want to be able to look at some different variables that tell you something different about, you know, different things about the jump. You don't want to look at three KPIs that all tell you the same thing. Then you're wasting your time. So you want to be able to boil it down to some KPIs or some, I'll call them some variables of interest. When I do my data, when we're talking about someone who's healthy and we're just trying to measure fatigue, I'm focusing on the creation of the jump. The jump height is important only as an output, but it's the creation of the jump. So I typically don't look at landings unless we already have identified a player who, hey, we need to look at their landing symmetry, or we need to look at their time to stability or something like that. I don't typically look at that from a fatigue perspective. I look at more of what's going on, and let's just focus, to make it simple, on counter movement jump. From the time I start my downward or my eccentric motion to the time that I'll call it get in the hole, you know, you're the deepest point in your squat, to the time when you lift off. I just focus on those areas because this is where your actually body is now having to actually produce the force to create the jump. So we typically look at four different areas that we're concerned about. The first is the loading when we're moving downward. So what we look at there, it's difficult to use force to quantify when a person's moving downward because of differences in technique. So what we look at is eccentric duration. How long were they squatting down? Lower is better. People who are tired tend to take a longer time to squat down. So we have to coach our athletes, and this is where the longitudinal part comes in. We want you to be springy, down fast, up fast. So we look at eccentric duration. Now, somebody might say, and they're right, well, why don't you just look at time to take off from the time that they start to jump till the time that they end? Well, I haven't published any papers on it. Someone may have, but I've looked at lots and lots of data. And what I see is that peak power and jump height and all these things that manifest itself in the concentric side of the jump are more related to the eccentric duration than the concentric duration. In other words, when you tell someone to jump and they try to jump as fast as they can, concentric durations don't change very much. The time from being in the hole to lifting off, those are pretty consistent when you start looking across people. It's the eccentric duration that changes. So we could look at time to contraction or time to takeoff as the sum of the eccentric duration and concentric duration. But just narrowing in on the eccentric duration band is enough. Now, that is a technique because we can coach someone to move faster. That has nothing to do with if they're a good jumper or bad jumper. That has to do with us getting them to exert maximal effort. So if they have a change in that number, then we say, okay, something's going on here. That's the first one. The second one is, what is the force they're pressing down with as they reach the bottom of the eccentric phase and reverse to move upwards? So in force plate terminology, that's force at zero velocity. This is limited by leg strength, how strong I can actually push into the ground, because this is where I'm stopping my body from going down. I'm pushing into the earth. This is where the peak of your force curve will come. So we look at that. We look at peak power, because peak power is giving us a measure of, okay, I have a certain amount of force. Can I express it fast? So power is force times velocity. So that's the third one. The fourth one that we'll look at is either reactive strength index or flight time contraction time. That gives us an indication. What I like to tell when I'm teaching or working at Rice, the students understand this completely. If you think of a jump as the preparation part and then the part in the air, the part in the air is your examination. The preparation part is your studying. You would prefer to have as least amount of studying with the best exam time in the air. So we want the RSI to be high. So we look at those four metrics. We also look sometimes at the concentric impulse. Sometimes we'll break the concentric impulse into the early propulsion phase and the late propulsion phase. But at the end of the day, these are what we found to be the metrics that when we look across all of them, help us to get a good picture of, is there something that's abnormal here, either on a increase side or a decrease side?
So when we then bring all of that together, I'd love to hear what you then do with that data and what it might look like when you start to make decisions. So let's say you've gone through that testing battery and you've got all of that great information. At what point do you then turn around and say, look, coach, this person is tired? And then what do you do with that information? So do you still allow them to play, or do you say, oh, maybe reduce time on the pitch? So what are the actions that you can take from this data, and where are your thresholds for taking those actions?
Sure. So, you know, a lot of the questions you're asking, Matt, this depends also on your role in the organization. If you are embedded in the team and you are a mainstay and you are involved with daily conversations, that's going to be different than if you are a consultant, like in some of my sports where I'm doing the work and then I'm giving some interpretation. So I'll speak more of from the consultant side. So first of all, a couple questions you asked there is, how do you know, like, what are you using to say that these numbers are different? There's lots of ways you can do this. The bottom line is, you want to know, when is a number not what you expect it to be? So there's acute to chronic load ratio is one of them. Nothing wrong with it. Everything's fine. But at the end of the day, you're looking for a difference. So what I do, it's real simple. I just create a Z-score and I look and see when is the number greater than or less than, when is the Z-score greater than or less than one? That means they're outside of their first standard deviation. Something's different here. What's important is that the Z-scores are individual. We do not have a team. Like we might create a team Z-score in order to help us understand where do people rank within the team. But from a fatigue perspective, we have to look at the person. And it's simply, if I have two athletes and one jumps with 5,000 watts and one jumps with 9,000 watts, and I just look at those two, I would say, oh, there's something wrong with the 5,000 watts. But the truth could be, no, the 5,000 watts is what this guy's norm is. So I can't be comparing him to the 9,000 watts if I'm talking about fatigue, especially if the 9,000 watt guy's job is different than the 5,000 watt guy's job. So, like I said, we try and keep it as simple as possible, because remember, us science geeks can make this really complicated. Coaching people typically don't want complication. They want simple. What does this mean? How can I understand it? I remember when I was working about 10 years ago, I did some consulting with the San Antonio Spurs, and Jack Ransone, who I was working with, who was head of medical there, told me something just off the cuff that I always remember. He said, remember, whatever we do, when we give it to Coach Pop, it has to be on a 3x5 card. That's what we have to distill this information down to. So I've always carried that with me, is I can spend as many hours and write as many codes and do as many machine learning analyses as I want. It has to now translate to something small. So the first part of your question was, we look at Z-scores. The second part is, I don't take a role personally in telling a coach what they should or should not do. I take the role in telling them, hey, the numbers are off. And I let them then decide what they should do about it. Now, if they ask me for a recommendation, I'll give them a recommendation. But I think it's really dangerous for us to say, oh, we're going to say that if this number is below Z of minus one, it's a red light. They can't play. That's very dangerous. First of all, that could really frustrate the coaching staff and the player. And then secondly, you could be making a mistake, because that could be a one. Remember, this data is filled with noise. That could be a one-off. So I think what it does is it starts the conversation. Quick anecdotal story of how this one of the things manifested itself. I had a player on one of my teams in the past who was showing asymmetries in jump, counter movement jump data when we were measuring on a regular basis. On the court, they were performing fine, but they were saying, yeah, something doesn't feel right. And after we measured jumps and found asymmetry, and by asymmetry, I'm just talking force production on the left side versus the right side, out of the normal bounds of what this guy typically expressed three times in a row, I said, you might want to check this guy. Medical said, yeah, you know what? Let's go ahead and have him have an x-ray. He had a fractured bone in his foot. They were able to pull him out and start his rehab immediately, which got him onto the court right away. If they were using his report and his output on the court, they wouldn't have pulled him from the court. That could have potentially led to a larger injury. So this is where the data can be useful, but it's not a, oh, he was asymmetrical, he can't play. It's, hey guys, medical staff, this is what I'm seeing. You might want to check into it.
I think that's excellent. John, that's a fantastic insight into how you can use force plates, but also fatigue as well. So massive thanks for your time and wisdom there. Where can people find a little bit more about you and what you're up to?
So I have a website, DeWittMethod.com, and this is where I base main contacts for me for questions, for the type of consulting I do. I'm still developing the website, so it's a work in progress. LinkedIn is a great place to find me. I don't know how many John DeWitts there are, but look for the one that says CSCS, PhD. And then I do have Twitter at jdewitt and Instagram at john.dewitt66. I have to admit, I use these more to see what other people are doing than posting my own information. So reaching out to me directly by LinkedIn or through my website would be the best way to get in touch.
Absolutely excellent. So John, massive thanks. It's been a pleasure. I look forward to speaking again soon.
Thank you, Matt. It's been great.
Cheers, buddy.
Thanks.
And that's it. Once again, a massive thanks to John for all of his hard work on today's podcast. I really appreciate it. I'm sure you do at home too. Before you leave, I want to point you in the direction of the Science of Sport Coach Academy. The Coach Academy is an overgrowing library of sports science courses, which are broken down into bite-sized chunks. That means you can fit them in and around your basic coaching schedule. What's more, every time you complete one of the courses, you get a certificate of completion, which will prove your ongoing education. So, if you've enjoyed today's podcast, you want to get your in there completely for free for the next 7 days, all you have to do is hit the link in the show notes in just a few seconds' time. And of course, if you have enjoyed today's podcast, it'd be fantastic if you could recommend us to a coach, a colleague, an athlete, or a friend. That means that we can keep bringing you the best possible guests and the best possible content. And that's it. Once again, a massive thanks from me. I'm Matt Solomon of Science Sport, and I'll speak to you next week.